In English yesterday, Pope Francis said the Catholic Church has been too focused on abortion, contraception, and homosexuality. The Pope says, time to move on, Church, and his remarks have been welcomed with both joy and suspicion. It's just one big story making headlines in a very busy week, and joining us to mull over some of the highlights, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, and Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. That was alphabetical, by the way. Sometimes I do it in a clockwise rotation, but this is alphabetical.
This is so good to know, yes.
All right.
Am I the only one who thought the Pope's interview and the revelations in it were kind of ground shifting? I'm not Catholic, but we mentioned it on the air and emails started coming in.
He's the front page Pope is what he is, because he is constantly making headlines that demand that kind of attention, you know, coming out and saying things that popes before had not had the thought or the guts to say. And specifically, he's been talking about expanding the tent of the church, a home for all, he likes to say, not some small chapel that's stuck in doctrine. And one of the more interesting things that maybe perhaps drove it to the front page is his position on gays and gay marriage. Earlier, he had said, who am I to judge? And it was left sort of unclear if that comment had applied to gays in the priesthood. But he made very clear in this interview with La Civiltà Cattolica.
Oh, very nice.
Trying, very good. That it really applied to all gays and lesbians, that he meant it broad.
Well, it's interesting because in a church some of whose leaders used their parishional power, if that's the word, to preach against I-74, same-sex marriage, here's this Pope who, this is a quote, said the church's pastoral ministry cannot be obsessed with the transmission of a disjointed multitude of doctrines to be imposed insistently.
It would have been nice to hear that a year or two ago.
Yeah. He wasn't Pope then.
That
would have been a tough call because, you know.
but it's so refreshing and a bit exciting to be able to agree with the Pope for once. It's very, very nice. And to see him talking not just about gay rights and abortion, or I guess I would, it's not exactly gay rights, but he's done talking about gays
right. And
abortion. And he's also been talking about economic justice. He's been talking about including women more fully in the roles of the church. And so it's really interesting and exciting. And Frank Bruni, I think at the New York Times, put out an interesting tweet yesterday. It's amazing to have a Pope who is to the left of the Republican Party now. Or a party in the United States that's more conservative than the Pope, in other words.
Well, it seems that sort of the grassroots response has been very excited because, especially in this country, there have been a lot of Catholics who have felt at odds with the doctrine that comes from the Vatican. But as far as what I've read, the leaders in the church, the entrenched leadership, is not so happy with this Pope.
Yeah, some of them are coming down on him for saying, you mean to tell us that you don't have the same position we have, for example, on abortion? But what is happening, and I've heard, you know, profoundly lapsed Catholics say, wow, I could go back. I could be connected to this church if it's going to be that big tent. One of the things that he said in this interview that was distributed pretty widely, that he's never been a right winger. He doesn't even like that. He wants so much to be the man of the people, the washing of feet of juvenile offenders, of all the different things that he has done, that he's signaled over and over again. He's only been there for about a couple minutes so far, and the actions have been pretty big to say, I don't want to be focused on this doctrine. I want to be focused on sort of humanitarian concerns.
Can they recall a pope if they're upset with him at the upper levels? I don't know enough about how the workings of the church. I'm the wrong person. And Eli Sanders,
I think,
shaking his head.
We're
the wrong people.
Actually, persuasion.
My favorite, it wasn't my favorite part of the interview, but I thought it was sort of interesting. His favorite movie is Fellini's La Strada. So I always like knowing that about people.
Well, you know, he is raised by Italian parents in Argentina, but he is Italian.
Argentinian.
Focus.
Yeah.
Focus.
He may also be noticing the same thing that some in the Republican Party here in the United States are noticing, which is that they are on the wrong side by a long shot of demographic shifts. And so if the church, like the Republican Party, continues to be obsessed with gays and abortion, two issues where a lot of people in Western countries, including the United States, are shifting dramatically in their opinions, then it will become less and less relevant.
I think, actually, if we could talk about the Republican Party shift as to Obamacare, or what they refer to. The Affordable Care Act, referred to even by Obama as Obamacare. Listeners have taken us to task. The president has adopted that term, so we kind of go along with it as a shorthand. But I like to call it the Affordable Care Act. But this morning, the House passed a budget by a wide margin that would defund health reform plan.
It would keep the government going, but it would defund Obamacare. It'll now go to the Senate, where absolutely nothing will happen with that piece of legislation.
And so they know that it won't keep the government going because it will never pass the Senate. And so what they are actually doing is setting us on more of a rapid course toward a government shutdown and possibly a debt default. That is the consequence of what the Republicans in the House did today.
October 1st is the deadline, I believe, or September 30th, midnight between those 2 days, for them to reach something, if not just an extension. I want to, just before we move on to domestic and local affairs, the president of Iran is coming to the United States on Sunday. And it's just a fascinating thing. Here's this country that is, we have ostracized. Our Syrian policy is being developed with Iran in mind. And here's this new president, speaking of new leaders, tweeting Happy Jewish New Year to the Jews of the world and wanting to sit down with Obama.
Writing an op-ed. That's the new thing, to write an op-ed. This one was in the Washington Post, and trying to sound like a man sort of more future-oriented, worried about the economy of his own country, and sort of wanting to say, hey, can't we all get along? Where did this come from?
Yeah, it does. I don't know. Should we just doubt it all? Are we being too rosy, glassed about it?
Diplomacy is a good thing. Talking with people, other people, and even enemies is a good thing. I mean, it doesn't resolve every dispute. But I certainly think that it's a heck of a lot better than painting yourself into a corner where your only option is to attack whatnot. So he's certainly saying things that are encouraging. There's the old Reagan line about trust but verify. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of diplomacy, is you want to listen to what they say. You want to have some trust that they're telling you what they actually think, what they can actually do. But proof is always in the pudding. So it's whether you're talking about Assad or whether you're talking about the Iranians, the proof is going to be in terms of what kinds of agreements can be worked out in terms of their nuclear capability and whatnot. So it's a good thing. I mean, it was a fundamental part of Obama's whole election initially, was bringing a different kind of approach to foreign policy.
You're talking about the first election,
yeah,
right?
I'm talking about the first election, and diplomacy is, I mean, he hit a rough patch on Syria. It's a very tough thing to succeed in terms that will make all Americans happy when you're dealing with the rest of the world. But I can't see this as anything other than a positive, even if it's a baby step.
We're talking over the week's news. Knut Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders. Eli, you paying any attention to Iran, news from Iran?
I am. I like this storyline about their exchange of private letters. Mm-hmm. So I agree with Knut. Diplomacy is a good thing. And also, sanctions are a powerful thing. I think what you're seeing here, and what a lot of people say we're seeing here, is the Iranian leadership having had enough of the ever-tightening sanctions, that they are very powerful in terms of their effect on Iran's economy, and it's recently been more thoroughly cut off from the international banking system. And so I think that is part of what's behind this. They need to get reconnected to the world monetarily.
And this particular president has made that a priority. Rouhani, not our president.
Right. Well, our president
as well, right?
Also, and it's again kind of relieving to see this season of very I guess, I don't know if you can call the Pope is not exactly a theocrat, but theological leaders kind of softening their views and opening themselves up to reconciliation and negotiation. It's quite amazing.
I heard something on the national news about how this new president wants to be the anti-Ahmadinejad. He wants to be the opposite. He wants a new era for Iran. It's like, all right, where did this come from?
I know that the people of Iran, at least from things I've read, because I haven't been to Iran, but I've been reading a lot about this, were by the end of the 8 years of Ahmadinejad embarrassed in of how they were being portrayed on the world stage, which is an interesting thing. I guess I'm with all of you. The idea that you'd sit down and talk just seems like a much better path than that you sit down and bomb each other and then
far
talk.
Cry from the axis of evil kind of rhetoric that we had heard earlier.
Any bets? Want to place any bets on whether President Obama will actually sit down with the Iranian president?
I don't know if I'm willing to place a bet, but I'm very interested to see whether that happens. I mean, the potential benefits of this are just so huge. Think of how long we have spent staring at each other suspiciously, preparing to hurt each other, to really not a lot of great benefit to either side. And so if there can be some movement and some way to kind of mutually agree to stand down from the brinksmanship that has characterized the relationship between Iran and not just the United States for such a long time, it just could be a really huge and positive change in international relations.
The other thing I heard this morning, and I haven't had a chance to follow up, was that Syria apparently had given it a catalog of its chemical weapons to an NGO, I believe.
This was the deadline. It was a week from last weekend. I wasn't sure if it was today or tomorrow, but we're supposed to get a list. That's the details of that agreement.
So we'll be looking for that as well, and you'll hear more on that as the day continues here on KUOW, as does our Week in Review conversation continue. Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, I'm Marcy Silman. This is KUOW.
LA's Sunset Strip launched the careers of everyone from the Doors and the Byrds to Van Halen and the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Ever since the 60s, this has probably been the most famous mile of music in America.
But many of those legendary clubs have lost their cool, and some are calling it quits. I'm Arun Roth, the fading Sunset Strip, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All right, thank you. Tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is David Green from NPR News. You can rely on KUOW and NPR for thoughtful reporting and analysis you can trust. And we rely on you. Listeners provide the financial support that makes all of this possible. Your support right now will help keep the upcoming fall membership drive on target so that we can get you back to regular programming sooner. Please mail in your gift, or you can pledge online today at KUOW.org. And thanks.
67 degrees and partly sunny in Seattle, expecting to reach 73 this afternoon. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:20.
It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman, and we're talking about things that are happening in the world, which we don't often get to do in this panel, and here at home with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knut Berger. Let's bring it on home. Seattle's heated mayoral race is hotter than ever. Another poll has put Ed Murray out in front of incumbent Mike McGinn. Meanwhile, the mayor's unleashed a no-holds-barred his attack. It continues, and he's good at it. Watching him, the King Television poll has Murray up with 52%, and that prompted McGinn's spokesman John Weibel to talk about how accurate this poll could be if most of the people contacted were on landlines instead of cell phones. So before we go to that discussion about the reliability of polls, this is the second poll. Let's just talk about the poll itself. This is the second one in a couple weeks, right? This is the same one that has him up?
This is the first one we've seen.
This is the first one that I've seen.
The same poll. This is the same polling group that had Malahan up, right?
I don't know.
I believe
that. I would believe it. And I think, you know, what Weibel is saying is not without some validity. I don't know that you get a 20-point margin just based on the inaccuracy of using landlines and not cell phones. But the mayor's point may be, look, I have a lot of support among younger people, among people who don't potentially have cell phones. The people who you are undercounting are my supporters. And so you could see more accurate polling revealing something different, maybe a 10-point lead for Murray. I don't know that you make up 20 points just based on the inaccuracy of the type of polling.
I've written about polling and the use or non-use of cell phone voters, and it's a very important number. And so I think Weibel has a point here because, as Eli said, younger voters, many of them, and those tend to be McGinn supporters, younger voters tend to have cell phones only. There is a cost to a polling company. It's very expensive because you have to hand dial, by the rules, the folks who you're going to call on the cell phone. And because you can't auto dial a cell phone, because then there's this old rule that you would then be caught, and maybe you caused a car wreck or something like that. But so it's very expensive. So that's why this poll only had 10% cell phones. It would be a different outcome, maybe not a flip or anything like that, but it would be a different outcome if there were more cell phones. That makes us sort of a safer sample, because it represents, at one point, cell phones were only like 5 or 6% of the real total. It's up to, like, last time I looked, which was a couple years ago, 22%.
Well, it's more. It's got to be higher than
and
that.
And it's more than that now. So that is a point.
Well, the other thing I wonder is the bigger question about polling in general, and what role does polling play in all of this? I mean, you could look at that if you were sitting on the fence and go, Ed Murray's out in front, and either I don't need to think about this because that's the guy who's going to win, or I'm going to vote for that guy because he's out in front, depending on your bent. And I start wondering about just what these things exist to tell us something, but what do they actually do to us?
Or do they become self-fulfilling prophecies?
Exactly.
Well, one of the things, I think Ed Murray is running a front runner's campaign. It's what we're hearing a lot about is endorsements of all kinds, unions, establishment endorsements, city council endorsements. He's racked up, I think, 5 of the city, mm-hmm. sitting city council people so far have publicly endorsed him. It's not a big risk campaign. He's not running a campaign where he's stating bold vision. Somebody described it to me, Murray supporter described it to me yesterday as a rope-a-dope campaign. And I think what they meant by that is he's avoiding a lot of the kind of engagement that would probably serve McGinn, who one is very good at that kind of thing. And as we pointed out before, McGinn is running an underdog campaign, even though he's the incumbent, and spreading a lot of money around. At least if you judge by his emails, many more came out this week with
more proposals for more funds for more things in every part of the city. Well, if you talk about this as a rope-a-dope campaign, immediately the vision came to me of Mike McGinn, because he is a sparring machine. I mean, he's hitting the jabs. I don't have any boxing analogies here, but, he's got a lot of fast.
You were on a roll.
I was on fast footwork, landing the punches on Murray. Apparently, I wasn't there. Were any of you at this particular, I'm not sure what event it was, where he needled Murray enough that Murray snapped back at him?
I think it was a debate at Garfield High School.
Is that where it was?
They've been pounding on one another here. And McGinn certainly has been spreading money around, especially in regards to the sort of big news of the week, which was the stabbing in Pioneer Square that sort of blows up the public safety issue back to the front burner in this race. McGinn did not try to act like there's a conspiracy to make public safety the issue. He walked right into it and said, we're going to have 15 more officers. We're going to have a mayoral summit on mental health issues. And then he kept spending money on some other things that would go for various other things. But he had a rough week, the mayor, because 5 of 9 city council members is pretty unusual for endorsements. I can't think of another mayoral race when that occurred. And then the police officers guild went for Ed Murray. And so it was one of those weeks.
Well, let's leave mental health for just a second, and we will return to that, because I think that's a bigger issue than public safety, although it does play into events both here and at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. Knut, you mentioned endorsements. The Police Officers Guild, it's not the chiefs that were doing the endorsing. This is the rank and file. So this is a labor organization. It's one of the labor organizations that has fallen the other way. Last week we talked about Mayor McGinn getting big endorsements from big unions. And here's this rank and file group that the mayor purported to represent in the conversations with the police monitor and the Justice Department. And they did not go for him. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, too, because I think McGinn had been seen to in his confrontation with the Department of Justice seem to be taking a position that would be somewhat sympathetic there. And I'm not sure that was necessarily a correct reading, but that was how people were estimating. I think that Murray, one of his strengths is as a bringer together of people and someone who can negotiate things. He's someone you can talk to, and I'm putting air quotes around that in the sense that, and I think that has appeal when you have because I think that one of the criticisms of McGinn is he digs in and takes such a contentious approach on so many things that it makes resolution of those things difficult. So anyway, I think that's a very – I think it is an interesting endorsement, but I don't completely understand the politics behind it.
No, in his endorsement proclamation, if that's the right word, the Guild President Rich O'Neill said part of it was because Murray promised to make public safety his number one priority, but we just have the mayor this week saying the same thing.
And also using his announcement to hire 15 officers
right.
to sort of talk to a smaller group of voters. He said that the hiring would occur from, you know, heavily from within the minority communities. And he made a point of that, how important that was to him. So that has some sway in here, too.
It was very, very interesting to see the Police Guild just mouth the message that the Downtown Seattle Association has been pushing, that the Murray campaign has been pushing, that McGinn is soft on crime, essentially, not good on public safety. And I agree, it was a surprising turn after McGinn, from my reading, or I thought this was one possible reading, worked so hard to align himself with them during these negotiations that you were talking about and upset people in his base in doing that. And I sat there and thought, I wonder if he's playing for the Police Guild endorsement in his reelection campaign. So either way, to not get it must have been a very bitter pill for him. And then he just goes right back onto what he's been doing, which is, like you said, announcing new money, announcing new cops, talking to particularly to the communities that he thinks will help him get reelected.
It's a fascinating race to watch, to try to look at it from the outside. All of us at this table live within the Seattle city limits, so we approach this as both journalists and voters. But it is an interesting thing to watch and to watch this mayor as a campaigner, which I think he's a really great campaigner.
And, you know, one thing about that poll quickly, it's not bad for McGinn to be behind if he's running as the underdog and the outsider and the person who doesn't have as much support and backing from the establishment, as he puts it, as others. And this was actually the thing that got under Murray's skin at that debate that you were referencing. When Murray snapped at McGinn, it was because, in my reading of the reports on this meeting, it was because McGinn had been talking about Murray's establishment money, his backing from powerful interests and companies and then power brokers in downtown.
Yeah, but he's the outsider with his hand on this budget, and I would love to take a look at the city budget. Where is all this new money coming from?
Well, I think, you know, the person with the uphill to climb is McGinn. And the results of the primary, I think, demonstrated that. You had McGinn got almost 30% of the vote, tying Murray, but 70% of the people voted for somebody else. Now, mm-hmm. the electorate changes in the general election. It's a different profile. And there's the grassroots efforts and the things that McGinn is very good at. Nevertheless, he has to get a lot of cows into the barn. In terms of voters, he has to move a lot of folks into.
I thought that was horses, but okay.
Horses, whatever. I mean, he's
a city guy. He doesn't get
the, yeah,
some,
that's right.
some kind of livestock.
He must Something get the voting land. Livestock.
He's got a herd.
Yeah, herd them back into his barn, or whatever you herd them into, and.
A car wash, of course.
And, you know, even though the poll may be a little bit inaccurate or whatever, he really has that onus. Now, he's very good at the sort of wedge issue and some high symbolic issue kind of things. I mean, and I would say that what that poll suggested was so far the kind of critique of Ed Murray's Olympia performance. That so far that isn't sticking particularly. I mean, it's a legitimate line of attack, but that isn't sticking, and the mayor is going to have to reset the campaign so it's about something other than McGinn or not McGinn.
Eli?
I'm not sure if I agree with that just based on the fact that we are in September, and this poll was conducted probably mid-September, maybe a little earlier than mm-hmm. mid-September. Everyone in politics talks about how no one pays attention until after Labor Day. And so I think it's a little too soon to know whether that critique of Murray is sticking or not. I think maybe by October you'll be able to tell. And the way that I read that poll was as a confirmation of something that we talked about quite a bit during the primary, which was that McGinn beat out the, you know, long list of challengers, or at least came in second place when there are a lot of people dividing up the vote, but we never saw him get above 25, 30%. And so what we may be seeing in this poll is his ceiling. And if that's true, that is, if that's a firm ceiling, that's an insurmountable obstacle to winning. And I think that's part of the aggressiveness that you're seeing from McGinn now. He needs to either, if it's a ceiling, he needs to break through it.
Right.
If it's not a ceiling, he needs to tear Murray down so that he can, you know, rise in the polls.
Well, if you've talked to McGinn supporters, one thing they are bullish about, and perhaps rightly so, is their get out the vote effort. And this really does come down to who gets their voters out.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen an increase in the sophistication of this with the governor's race last year. But talking to some of the McGinn supporters, they are absolutely convinced that his get out the vote operation is the best in the biz, and that it will be significant. In other words, he'll boost above 30, obviously, in part because of their ability to get out the vote.
Well, he did that very well in the primary.
In 2009,
right.
Which is the more telling.
It's interesting now because was 2009 all mail-in? I can't remember
yes.
when we changed
yes.
that.
Yes.
You know, the ballots will go out in, I believe, less than a month at this point, right? Mid-October, mm-hmm. they'll drop in our homes. We get these little weird mailings now, like you're going to get a ballot. You get a mailing. A ballot's going to come to you in 2 weeks. Okay, you know, put that aside. But it's an interesting thing. And so you're thinking about elections if you're old like me in a different way than you did when you just went to a place on a particular day and voted.
Well, when you look at the get out the vote efforts, these are identifying who your voters are and then calling them to badger them to get their ballots in. And they actually might make 3 or 4 or 5 phone calls to a particular voter and actually help them walk, you know, have you received your ballot? Have you filled out your ballot? Have you mailed your ballot? I mean, walking them through the process, and that pays dividends.
I experienced that personally. My daughter moved to California but forgot to cancel her ballot during last year's race. There were 7 voter contacts, some in person, some on the phone. I do believe they would have come to the house and physically removed the child to get the ballot.
I've never gotten one of those calls. I think it would be fun. We're talking over the week's news. We are here with Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders. I'm Marcy Silman, and I think we're going to take a short break because we'll reset topics when we come back here on The Week in Review on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the merchants at SeaTac Airport, including Travelex Worldwide Money in the main terminal, baggage claim on Concourse A, and in the South Satellite, featuring currency exchange for international travelers. Information on SeaTac Merchants Mileage Plan participation at SeaTacShops.com.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, economist Caroline Radcliffe tells how the stock market crash now 5 years ago has affected people of color. David Dinkins, New York's first and only black mayor, discusses his new memoir. And Michael Campos, director of the MAC, tells us how his 1973 film is gaining new respect. On the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis Smiley Show begins this morning at 11 o'clock. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from St. Martin's University, welcoming Dr. Eboo Patel, interfaith leader and author of Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America, to campus Thursday, October 3rd at 7 p.m. Reservations at stmartin.edu/EbooPatel.
67 degrees in Seattle, expecting to hit 73 for our high this afternoon, and the forecast says it's going to be partly sunny all day. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:38.
It's The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman, talking over things that have happened in our world, our neighborhood, our country, with Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger and assistant political editor at the Seattle Times, Joni Balter. And we mentioned a few minutes ago that a soccer fan was fatally stabbed after last Friday's Sounders game. He and his fiance, I believe, were walking out of the game, and a mentally ill man with a knife attacked the fiance. And when the man who was a Shoreline Community College instructor or professor stepped in front, he was fatally stabbed. I believe his fiance is still alive. And the mayor responded to that by saying, we really need to rethink our public safety. We're going to have at least 15 more police officers. But it's the whole issue, we've talked about this, and Knut, you've been particularly passionate on the subject of how we deal with the mentally ill, and what resources we have, but it's what resources we don't have, I think, or what we don't put into it. And so, I mean, there's two ways to talk about this, the resource issue and the political ramifications. Where do you want to start?
Well, just to pick up on the political ramifications, which ties into the mayor's race, I wrote a piece this week about which candidate would be the mental health candidate. Of course, what I meant by that was, we've talked about it a lot on the show over time, is there is a serious problem with the mental health system and treatment, and whether it's the Washington D.C. issue shooter, the Navy Yards, or the stabbing downtown. And I give credit to McGinn for coming out with right away with a list of things that he wanted to work on, and the summit, and that it isn't just a matter of more cops, although that is, I think, an important part of the picture, but the real issue is treatment, assessment, accessibility, and the legislature's cut tens of millions of dollars from Medicare and various reducing beds available. Turns out, Seattle hasn't been able to get Western State to evaluate a lot of the people that it sent down there. It's just broken. And it's also getting starved. And my feeling is that, if Seattle, Tim Burgess has had this idea that, of universal preschool, which is a way of Seattle kind of getting together to address an issue that, that is not, it's saying we can do better than what the norm is. And I think we have to do the same thing, Seattle and King County, on mental health. And I think this will be also fodder for criticism of Ed Murray, who has signed off on budgets that where this has been reduced. McGinnis certainly brought that point out. It's a legitimate point to say, you know, you're choosing to some really critical parts of the social safety net to cut, and there are consequences to that.
It's already being used as fodder. There's an email from McGinn's campaign outlining how Ed Murray is, as they say, hiding from his record of mental health service cuts. And then they go through all of the cuts that Ed voted for over the last many years to the social safety net and to mental health services. And McGinn has also made the point, again, that this goes back to Olympia. He on the one hand, he's saying, well, Seattle maybe just needs to fund this on its own somehow. But Seattle can't fund it on its own at this point, and I'm not sure if it ever can. And so it needs the state to help rebuild the social safety net here and fund increased mental health services. And the state has not been doing that.
And don't forget, there is a King County levy that was passed, I believe, in 2007 that collects, what is it, one-tenth of a cent on the sales tax for mental health. But there were some cuts at the state level. This is a ping-pong ball going back and forth here because as McGinn says, well, Murray signed off on these budgets that cut money for mental health at the state level. The counter is McGinn did not keep hiring police officers at the rate that he was supposed to during the recession. He stopped that. And so back and forth we go here.
And I just have to read something that came from one of our editors. The shooter in the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard case, Aaron Alexis, had a tie to Seattle. He had shot out, I think, a neighbor's tires, and he had clearly a rage issue and a gun issue. And so the Office of King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg, in responding to the question whether this guy slipped through the cracks of mental health and prosecution, Satterberg says a case was never referred to us for a charging decision. We only handled the first appearance on June 4th, 2004. The court released Alexis on his personal recognizance, set his second appearance for June 7th, which is the 72-hour deadline. A case was not referred to King County. SPD, Seattle Police Department, indicated that the detective referred the case to Seattle Municipal Court about a week later. So in addition to services, the whole justice system and where these cases go and whether social workers, as Pete Holmes has talked about, deal with this stuff or they go to the courts, it seems that that's equally as confused as who's funding what.
Well, the whole keeping track of who has a record is very much front and center because of the D.C. case. The New York Times had a fascinating piece that the same company that did clearance for Snowden had done the clearance for Aaron Alexis. And I don't know what, you know, their methods are, or they have different levels of where they check. But too many things obviously were slipping through the cracks for this company, missed a few things.
And I think you're right that the court system is an equally important part of solving this puzzle. And from what I've read and from what the King County Prosecutor's Office and Seattle Municipal Court are saying, he did slip through the cracks here.
Right.
It was basically people pointing at each other and saying, oh, this is someone else's job, and no one actually following through to see whether he was referred to the right court and forced to appear.
And I saw a headline that also said the King County Prosecutors asked for $25,000 bail for Aaron Alexis, and that sort of didn't happen.
I think it was in that sort of black hole between the two courts. Well, one thing that I know, you know, this crime, the stabbing crime, happened in Pioneer Square. The neighborhood itself has complained that partially this is because so many social services, what we do fund, ends up being located in that particular neighborhood. And I know that a lot of the merchants are upset. They're hoping that the new sort of, what do they call it, market rate housing that's going up in the north parking lot of the old King Dome. Sorry, it's called CenturyLink Field, the football stadium place, is going to put more eyes on the street. And that the hope is that some of these services for people who really do need them get less concentrated, get diluted throughout the city.
More people on the street is always a good idea. But, you know, we also have this issue where people who are doing these sort of non-jailable offenses, but sort of are indicators of behavior that could become troublesome. You know, when they have multiple citations and they're not, there's no consequences for them. The consequences usually are a way to bring them into services, drug court, mental health services, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But if in some ways we have a little standoff there where the city attorney is not pressing these, sort of out of what is purported to be a humanitarian interest, but maybe the more humane thing is to go after these repeat offenders to get them into the services.
There has been some dispute about whether Holmes is going after any prosecutions at all when it comes to these sorts of things.
To low-level.
Low-level. Not offenders. Stabbings, obviously. But, you know, the fact is that there's a range of crime that happens on the streets of Seattle. Some of it is just annoying, and some of it is deadly.
And this is an incredibly complex issue. You can talk about that problem. You can talk about something that I saw the Downtown Seattle Association said and that we were referring to a minute ago, that when you cut mental health funding, nowhere in the state is more impacted than Seattle, because this is kind of a catchment for all kinds of people who come here needing services. And then you can also look at this specific crime, which is tragic, but in the details involves a person who was in California and fled probation in California and slipped really through the cracks in California and ended up here, and after not very long committed this crime. And so it's actually a question in my mind as to what could have been done in this case with this individual. It's not clear that he had any interaction with law enforcement or the mental health system here in Washington State before this happened. California, on the other hand, maybe could have kept better track of him.
He's now in a California mental hospital. That's according to news reports. So I want to go back to, Knut, your pondering the mental health candidate. Who is it in your mind?
Well, I want to know. I would like to see more details from Mayor McGinn, but I'd also like to see a plan from Ed Murray, and like to be able to compare those and see who's getting it right. It is, you know, as Eli said, it's incredibly complicated. We talk about mentally ill as if it's one thing. It's not.
No.
It's complicated, the issue is it's not also completely predictive. In other words, that part of the trouble is trying to predict future behavior of people who have problems, and that's very difficult. And there are a lot of aspects of mental illness that are not criminal, but might contribute to an environment that other people find really uncomfortable. People talking out loud, people defecating in the streets, you know, whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of behavior that falls into another zone. And one of the issues that, you know, was hard to balance is, and the reason sometimes people's backgrounds aren't tracked down is that you have to meet certain fairly high bars to be considered a danger to get it in the record. In other words, all your neighbors may know you have a problem, but that's not necessarily going to come up at a background check. Unless you've been in the court system or there's some kind of, you know, specific record left. And so there are these privacy issues and rights issues that people have. If you wanted a safety net with a really fine grain, it would probably get pushback from a lot of other people who don't want it to be that fine grain.
Well, look at Aaron Alexis and his recent months and his interactions with government. And so he'd been to the VA hospital twice. He never mentioned that he heard the voices, but he said he had insomnia. He's had a string of events that if somebody was collecting all the information would have led to a warning flag, but nobody was collecting all the information. And sort of each time he came up short for a flag, like in other words, he got an honorable discharge from the Navy, but not a honorable. And so,
or just a discharge.
Or just a discharge. At this, as he went, every step, he was just below the point of the flag.
But it also brings up that question, which I've heard some mental health advocates talk about, which is that, and this isn't about homeless, this is just about people in general, that, you know, we had involuntary commitment for years, and it was the humane thing to get rid of in many cases. People were unduly either committed to mental institutions or incarcerated in jails and prisons that dealt with criminally insane, and that was not a good solution. So now we have this other conundrum. Then, you know, how do the sieve, the fine mesh net that we're talking about, you know, some people warrant locking up, some people don't. There's civil rights involved, too.
Right. There's a huge civil liberties question here when you get into it. And the deeper historical context is exactly what you're referring to. In, you know, decades past and not very long ago in this country, hundreds of thousands of people were institutionalized against their will, often for no good reason. And so there was a move toward community treatment in the Carter administration, I believe. And the problem is that there was never enough funding provided. And we see a very stark example of this here in Washington State. There has never been enough funding provided for community treatment. And so you really dial back on the number of people who are institutionalized, but you don't provide enough funding for the people who need treatment in a community setting. And of course, you get a lot of scary outcomes on the street.
We could talk about this for an hour, but I want to make a really inelegant turn right now, which is that we're
the bad segue.
Really bad segue. And I want to. It's close by, really, geographically. We've been talking a lot about Pioneer Square. I want to just move south to Soto or the sports neighborhood or whatever we're calling it now. Knut, you went to one of the public hearings about Chris Hansen's proposed new arena. There were two of them to be held, and there was an environmental impact statement issued. So,
right.
Where did you
attend?
Well,
it was at Seattle Center last night. There was a draft environmental impact statement. Say up front, I have not read it. It's, I think, 2,000 pages. But I did go because people were testifying. Pro and anti-arena folks were there. The longshoremen were there in force, and a lot of labor unions, the railroad workers, people representing the you know, it was a really interesting thing because it's the argument between the Sonics fans and the Sonics fans who don't want the arena in Soto.
So everybody's a Sonics fan.
Everybody likes the Sonics. Nobody's anti-basketball. The question is, you know, Ken, and I think the longshoremen and the shipping people were making a very compelling case in terms of there's sort of the small picture dispute, which is the traffic that the new arena would bring is going to make a situation that's bad already worse in terms of freight and that kind of thing. And there are more trains coming through already. So there's that big issue. But then there's the larger issue, I think, which is really interesting, which is the critique on the part of a lot of people in industry who basically say there's a huge monopoly game going on in Soto to drive up property values and to drive the port out in order to get some of that great waterfront property for condos. And this is not about the arena. This is about trying to transform that neighborhood in a way that would push industry out. And of course, their case is the port can't go anywhere. The Elliott Bay is a fixed place. Harbor Island, these places exist and they can't be moved, but an arena can be moved. So it was just interesting discussion and debate.
That's been the subtext for some time. You know, what kind of city, what kind of area will that be? What about the city's manufacturing base? You know, those are good paying jobs, and that's a big contributor to the general fund and all of that. And then here comes a proposal that may just be pure yuppification.
I'm curious. I know that the Mariners have had an official position against this new arena. Have they flipped? Were they represented?
No, they weren't, and they've kind of backed off the objections.
I say that only because their owner, their majority owner, died 2 days ago in Japan, Hiroshi Yamauchi. He was 85 in his death. The man never, ever came here to see the team.
He was adamant about that. You know, he just wouldn't come for that. Skip told me in the green room a story of how he had traveled to Bellevue, I guess it was, or Redmond in the 80s. But he never came after he bought the team. And he didn't even attend the game that was held in Japan.
The Mariners went.
The Mariners had an opener there, and he didn't even attend that. But he did do what he thought was a favor for the city of Seattle. He invested. He was willing to buy the whole baseball team, but if you recall, and
They wouldn't let him.
Those meetings, the baseball owners were very suspicious of a Japanese owner at the time, and so they reduced his share at the time to 49%. It has increased over the years as he more generously kept buying pretty cool players.
Well, and it leaves the future of the Mariners wide open, which we'll have to discuss another time, because I have to ask Knute Berger, Mr. Football, in the last minute, you went to, I believe, your first Seahawks game or something?
No. Okay. But it was a first one, obviously.
And lightning struck.
Lightning did strike. I didn't have anything to do with that, but I got to watch the show.
And you were there making decibels?
I was there. I was hoarse the next day, so my son, you know, didn't hit me in the head or something. And it was amazing. I mean, everybody brought earplugs, and it was so unbelievably loud. I mean, I know they say it was like standing next to a jet plane,
right,
or whatever. It really was loud. It was so loud. When you took the earplugs out at the height of the noise, it was as if the noise was a physical thing. You know, it was like a thick mist or something. Well, there was rain, but it was really something to witness.
That's what Art Thiel was saying, that you could feel it in the press box. On Crosscut this week, Art had a really funny tongue-in-cheek video that he posted about the fact that, with the exception of the Mariners, Seattle sports teams, Washington State sports teams, if you want to throw the Cougars in there, are in some kind of, like, you know, it's sort of like the diplomacy that we're seeing at international levels. They're all winning games.
Football's all everything's happening at once.
I know. Football, and there you have it. Well, you were there. This was the big game. And it rained and it poured, and I have to say, I thought that at least some of those 60-some thousand people would have the good sense to come in out of the lightning. I mean, rain is one thing, lightning bolts another. Knute Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com, Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Nice to be with you guys.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you.
The Week in Review, produced by Jason Pagano, Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. This is 94.9 KUOW.
A berry picker strike continues at Sakuma Brothers Farms near Burlington. KUOW's Liz Jones reports on the underlying cause of the strike in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Strangers Genius Awards, providing cash grants to local artists every September in Seattle. More about the 2013 finalists in literature, art, performance, music, and film, and the awards show on September 28th at thestranger.com/genius.
It's been 500 years since the Protestant Reformation. Now, what, you may ask, does that have to do with the Eurozone Reformation?
The German word for debt is also the same word as a moral failure. So the connotation is quite clear. If you have a high debt burden, you have morally failed.
I'm Kai Rizdal. More from Germany before their elections this weekend. It's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6:30 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Group Health Cooperative. For more than 65 years, Group Health has stood for healthcare and healthcare coverage working together on the same side. One goal, Group Health. In-